Good afternoon and welcome back to our ongoing series Around the Horn with UBS Asset Management's Fixed Income Team. I am pleased to welcome this month's featured speakers, top portfolio manager and business heads from AM's Muni, Taxable Fixed Income and Liquidity Teams. We'll hear candidly from them on their views on markets and what they believe financial advisors should be focused on within the fixed income space. Joining us today, we have Anthony Liotti, head of the Fixed Income SMA Advisory Group, and our moderator for today, Dave Walczak, senior portfolio managers for AM's Liquidity Strategies, Dave Rothweiler, senior portfolio managers for AM's Short Duration and Liquidity Strategies, Philippe Telles, senior portfolio manager for AM's U.S. Corporate Fixed Income Strategies, Anders Nelson, portfolio manager for U.S. High Yield Corporate Fixed Income, David Michael, portfolio manager for emerging markets, and Chuck Grande, head of the municipal investment team. As I mentioned, Anthony is going to moderate our discussion today. So with that brief introduction, Anthony, I'll hand it over to you.
Great, Siobhan. Thank you. And good morning, good afternoon, everyone. And thanks for tuning in to the March edition of Around the Horn. I can't believe it is March already. And as we move through the midpoint of March, we continue to witness quite a bit of ebb and flow of data. As it continues to challenge, I'd say, many base case assumptions for rates for the Fed being either lower or even significantly lower at year end with each new data point being announced. Last week was the non-farm payrolls report for February. However, it really wasn't, you know, the February data that swayed the market sentiment. It was actually the revisions to the January report that showed not nearly as many individuals were hired than were first reported. Thus causing the market to take on, I'd say, a slightly more bullish posture to the Fed. But there you go. You move forward three business days. You come up to yesterday. We received the CPI data for February and the core consumer prices, which, as we all know, excludes food and energy, increased around 0.4% from January. So inflation, as we've been talking about here, it remains a bit stubborn. Which one would expect that a small bit of pivot towards more of a bear stance, right? This sort of ebbing and flowing rates that we continue to see here by the Fed, but it really hasn't happened. If you look back at the meeting that took place last week, might have been the week before, that Fed Chair Powell had with the House officials. He reiterated that it was going to be appropriate to begin lowering borrowing costs at some point this year, but really made it clear that we're not ready just yet. And as we're looking at this midpoint in March, it looks like June is that first time in which the market is really anticipating those cuts. I would say this, the data sets that I mentioned are obviously important, that being non-farms and CPI. However, I think the most important thing that the Fed is focused on is really, you know, the PC deflator and the core PC deflator, which does show improvement. Not at the aggressive pace that most are or had expected or have assumed, but I would say that this is normal, right? You don't come down off of those high levels at a very 45 degree angle. You know, the trajectory remains, you know, positive, and I think we are heading in the right direction. All this being said, I'd say that we need to focus on a bit of the bigger picture here, right? And that is that we're likely not heading back to prices of 2019. And when looking at the broad U.S. economy, you could say now that there is an argument that can be made that rates should be lower on the Fed funds standpoint by year end. And then there are those who feel like there's an argument that we could keep rates where they're at for the foreseeable future. I think that's a very, very interesting take on the market. And perhaps that's why the markets have remained in such a tight trading range for most of the first quarter of 2024. With all these assumptions, prognostications, market bets, you name it, you really haven't seen too much movement from a rates and performance for the broad fixed income market thus this year. I'd say midway through March, most indices within the IG investment grade arena are either flat to up 50 or down 50 basis points. So not great, not horrible. So I would just say it's basically been steady. So with that, let me turn it over to our PMs. And we'll start off like we always do on the front end of the curve with Dave Walczak. Dave, take us away, please.
Yeah, thanks, Anthony. I think you gave a pretty good overview in terms of what we're focused on here in the front end. Obviously, being in the front end, we're highly attuned to changes in the Fed's view from a policy standpoint. And really, you know, based on some of the recent rhetoric we've heard from FOMC officials, you know, no one's really indicating that there's this table pounding urge to cut rates. So, especially relative to some of the pricing that was in the market at the beginning of the year, you know, I think the Fed has successfully, you know, across the board pushed back, on some of that narrative. You know, just looking at Fed funds futures, it is pretty amazing. You know, again, you know, this is roughly about two months ago to the day. We were seeing about 168 basis points for the cuts priced in before the end of the year. And as we sit here today, there's about 83 basis points for the cuts priced in. So, you know, clearly, I think the market is paying attention to the Fed officials, obviously also to, you know, watching the data come in. As, and as you mentioned, you know, inflation, you know, yeah, you know, depending on some components, we did see some improvements, but, you know, some of the measures like the Supercore, that I know the Fed is particularly focused on. While it did slow from the print that we saw in January, you know, it still rose by 47 basis points last month, which I think most would argue was still a pretty strong figure. So I think the point is, you know, it seems like the Fed still needs to see further progress on inflation. You know, we are watching to see, of course, what they have in store for us at their meeting next week. Importantly, we will also get an updated dot plot. So, again, the last one that we have was as of their December meeting that showed a median expectation of three cuts by the end of the year. So I think a lot of folks will be focused on whether or not we see any changes to that with the updated dot plot. So with that, I'll hand it over to my colleague, Dave Rothwater.
Hey, thanks a lot, Dave. So Anthony, just from a, you know, more of a top-down macro view and in terms of sectors, you know, in terms of some of the things we like these days. You know, it's an old adage, as long as the economy grows, or at least has reasonable growth, risk assets tend to perform. So at this point, we still favor corporates. And within that sector, we still like A-rated financials. Just, you know, comparing A-rated industrials, which are also often quite rich, A-rated financials, particularly the money centers, offer value. If available, we also like the Canadian, Aussie, and Japanese banks as well, as they offer nice carry opportunities, which in the front end, you know, it's not an area we typically make a lot of big duration bets. It really comes down to what your carry is or what you can get over a treasury, and Yankee banks offer a nice opportunity in that space. So some of these names are plus 60 to 70 over treasuries in the three-year space relative to, you know, oftentimes sometimes plus 20, 25 in industrials. The Yankees are also liquid in the front end, given that a lot of Yankee banks fund themselves in the front end of the yield curve. So that continues to be a great spot for us. And then, you know, you've probably heard me say it before, we're still favoring prime AAA ABS, you know, and that offers a pickup of 35 to 40 in the 1 year space over industrials as well. So, you know, with that, I'll pass it on to Philippe.
Thanks, David. So for us, the 2024 IG story is one of one, heavy demand, and two, heavy supply. Firstly, on the demand side, we've had 19 weeks of continuous inflows into the asset class, and that is driven mostly by attractive yields, which have been moving in a tight range of between 5% and 5.5%. Secondly, on the heavy supply side of things, year to date, supply is running 30% higher compared to the same period last year. We are seeing companies front-loading issuance and taking advantage of investors' demand and subdued volatility in the marketplace. We are expecting supply to come down later this year, usually the case in election years like this year. Now, with increased supply, we are seeing more opportunities, particularly in the technology and consumer non-cyclical sectors, pharma sector, but also the financial sector, as mentioned by David earlier. Issuers in the sectors are funding large M&A transactions. They are coming to the market with large deals, offering attractive concessions, and most times credible deleveraging plans. On the other hand, there's a number of credit negative stories developing in the media and cable space. But broadly speaking, we are expecting USIG to remain pretty well supported here, backed by strong fundamentals and a solid corporate fundamentals. I'll stop here and pass it over to Anders.
Thanks, Philippe. High-yield spreads look rich given we are trading at the two-year tights, but the high-yield market is supported by strong credit fundamentals and market technicals. In contrast to spreads, all-in yields look attractive at 7.7%, which is high compared to historical averages and should keep us trading in a range. A focus point has been the primary market. There's been an increase in the number of new issues this year, but net supply is actually very low because most deals are refis, which is one reason why there's strong demand for the new bonds. We're also seeing more low-quality issuers coming to market, and this has really helped ease concerns around the upcoming maturity wall as they're extending maturities, and it's partially why the lower ratings have traded so well to start the year. On the fundamental side of things, we're almost done with Q4 earnings in high yield, and overall they've been better than expected, and credit metrics continue to look solid. This supports our view that default rates in high yield will remain manageable. Our analyst team is expecting 3.4% for the year. So to summarize our views in high yield, firstly, credit has remained resilient given the low supply and solid corporate fundamentals. And secondly, we think that the asset class offers investors an attractive high current income. So in case of that the rates stay higher for longer, you get paid while you wait. I'll now hand it over to David Michael to speak on emerging markets.
Thank you, Anders. The emerging market spreads have continued to rally across both EM sovereign and corporate credit. EM sovereign supply is running ahead of 2023, and we've reached about 50% of our 2024 projections. Most of this supply has come from high-quality investment-grade issuers. Emerging market corporate debt supply is running ahead of 2023 as well, but these levels are significantly lower than the average of what we've seen over the previous 5 years. We believe corporate supply will remain low this year for a number of reasons. There's been robust liability management over the past 3 to 5 years, so many short-term funding needs have been removed, but also most emerging market corporate issuers can access debt in domestic markets, and they can achieve more attractive funding levels compared to issuing in dollars and hedging back to their domestic currency. And similar to high yield, the liability management that we've seen in the past is what we continue to see this year, with supply from high yield issuers not only being very low, but net supply, meaning that total supply, less maturities and coupons, will realize net inflows into the asset class. China recently announced a 5% growth target, and we expect that they'll need to stimulate their economy to reach this target. Egypt announced a $35 billion direct investment from United Arab Emirates and an upsized $8 billion IMF program. And we've seen increased IMF support for emerging market countries over the last year. We've seen presidential elections in Pakistan, Taiwan, and Indonesia, and they've had little impact on market risk. We continue to monitor the remaining elections. India, South Africa, Panama, and Mexico will be coming up in the next few years, and the U.S. later this year. We expect uncertainty to reemerge in the second half due to U.S. elections, but we continue to have a positive outlook for emerging markets for the rest of the year. From here, let me hand it off to Chuck for an update from our municipal team.
Thanks, David. Overall, the muni market has seen positive technicals, very supportive of the market thus far this year. I will say that supply has been elevated. Estimates of February supply was up about 30%, but we believe this is front-loaded issuance because of the election coming up later in the year, where politicians will be more focused on getting reelected or their party reelected versus issuing debt to the muni market. On the other side of the coin, demand has been fairly robust from reinvestment of coupons, maturities, along with new money also contributed to the market. Year to date, open-end funds have seen net inflows of $8.5 billion, which in essence has been 47 sessions of inflows to the muni market versus only 3 sessions of outflows thus far this year. A very, very positive sentiment for tax-exempt municipal bonds. This balance of supply and demand has left year-to-date performance flat, up 8 basis points. And primarily that took place in the early weeks of the month of March, where we're up 46 basis points. Throughout this period, municipal AAA curve has been steady throughout March. And when we look at relative valuations to taxables, 2-year, 5-year, 10-year, and 30-year valuations all remain rich, where they've been most of the year. The 10-year area especially is overvalued in our view and is to be avoided in terms of investing for total return purposes. But what's the attraction? It's absolute yields. Absolute yields remain attractive, especially on an after-tax basis, in the context of what is expected to occur later in the year with Fed rate cuts expected in the second half. We do expect, as the month of March unfolds, technicals will weaken. We expect there to be volatility in the market as investors pull cash away, primarily in the end of March and April, to pay income taxes. And we think that volatility will certainly present opportunities, especially for those who have been waiting on the sidelines, for munis to cheapen relative to taxable securities. But that could possibly occur at absolute lower yield levels. So the investor is left with making a decision. Lock in higher yields now and slightly rich valuations, or lock in cheaper valuations and possibly lower yields later. With that, I will turn it back to Anthony.
Great. Thanks, all. Appreciate it. Well done. What I'd like to do now is bring in my colleagues, Neil Talbot and Steve Kanner. We've got a few questions that we'd like to pose to the PM team that we have been hearing on a fairly, I'd say, regular basis from both our financial advisors and their clients. And I think it would be really good to incorporate this into the call. So Neil, I'm going to start with you on the municipal side and pose your question to perhaps Chuck. Thank you.
Sure. Thank you. Good morning, everybody. This question and commentary is directed at Chuck, but really impacts anybody across fixed income right now. So Chuck, in a lot of the conversations I've had recently with clients and financial advisors, you can sense this dilemma on how and where to invest in this environment, specifically with the inverted yield curve that we have. So I've been in this asset class for a long, long time, and I can't remember munis being so inverted for so long. I mean, right now we have one-year munis yielding more than 15-year munis, and that really doesn't happen in this asset class. So what would your message be to clients that are hesitant in giving up the short end of the curve, giving up 3% for one-year munis or 5% for cash and money market funds and CDs and short treasuries, and taking on duration in this environment?
Good question, but I'll comment first that, Neil, I don't remember the muni yield curve being this inverted for this long ever, so I definitely share your sentiment. I do think that barbelling and looking at the construction of your portfolio in a holistic manner allows you to take advantage of the inverted yield curve. We ourselves do enjoy a large number of variable rate demand notes. We are still yielding in excess of 3%, as you mentioned. And certainly you can pick up nearly 3% for two, three, four, or five years when you look at the short end of the curve. So you can lock in some of these higher rates that we're experiencing right now on the front end and then weigh them versus going out longer on the curve, 15, 16 years out. That combined portfolio can give you a duration, a much shorter duration than just buying the long end of the curve and locking in yields today. So I think it's there to be taken advantage of. I think you can't look at it in the absolute window of I'm just going to own the front end or I just want to own long duration assets. I think by taking a holistic approach in your portfolio construction and using the barbell, which we've been doing on our active managed strategies, really provides the investor with the exposure that they want without the risk of having exposure to that middle area of the curve between five and 11 years.
Billy, if you're all set, I know Steve.
I am.
Yep, person or two. Oh, thanks, Phil. Steve, you want to take it away, Steve Kanner?
Sure, happy to. Thanks. So similar type of question focused on duration. I was hoping the portfolio managers responsible for the actively managed treasury solution, intermediate corporate bond, and then the crossover credit SMA could just give folks on the call an update on how we've been managing duration in these portfolios and what we've been up to. Maybe we'll start with the Davids.
Yeah, sure. So I can kick things off talking about our short duration treasury strategy. So, you know, there, if you look over the past few months, we have tactically adjusted duration. Back in November, we went long 0.05 years relative to the one-year treasury benchmark for the strategy. And then we pared that back a little bit in January and February to only a 0.03 year long. And as of right now, at least, we're actually sitting closer to neutral. So we have made some changes over the months, but as you can see, you know, nothing too big in terms of duration bets. I think, you know, we still want to get more confidence that, you know, the Fed is going to be, you know, embarking, you know, imminently on the rate cutting cycle. And then also, too importantly, you know, what the degree of that cycle looks like. So I think that'll kind of inform our next decisions going forward. But yeah, up to this point, it's really been just kind of more tactical moves around duration.
Thanks, David. Philippe?
Okay. So for the intermediate corp account, we're targeting a duration of 4.25. The index is just under 4. So we are about a quarter of a year overweight duration. And the way we're expressing that, there's a few ways we can do that. For new accounts, if the bonds are peaked to the point where our duration target's met, for existing accounts that we take in kind or have been aged for a while and duration is a little under the index, we can sell short bonds and buy longer dated securities. That way, we increase our duration to our target level. In the intermediate corp accounts as well, we have the flexibility to use treasuries. So we can quickly and without any transaction costs buy longer dated treasuries if the need be, if we already kind of on the cusp of on the corporate exposure. So it's a more flexible type of mandate that we can manage.
Awesome. Thank you. How about Anders, any updates on duration for the crossover credit strategy?
Yeah. So in terms of duration, we've been keeping it fairly close to home. It's pretty close to neutral. Recently, I'd say in the last 3-4 weeks or so, we have been shifting some of the front end tighter bonds into longer maturity buckets for the investment grade sleeve of the crossover strategies. On the high yield side, we have been looking to extend in maturities where appropriate in terms of the credit. So right now we're sitting on a duration of about 2.75 years.
I don't know if we've got time for another question, Anthony.
Yeah, we've got some time. Fire away, please.
Yeah, maybe we could just give a quick update on you know, relative value, you know, for triple or for double A's or single A's relative to triple B's, and maybe how, you know, that spread, how spreads look, triple B's to say double B's, if there's any value in either going up or down in credit quality.
I can start with that. So we track our relationship pretty closely, and currently, if you look at the broader A index versus the triple B index, that difference between the two is 35 basis points. Mm-hmm. 35 basis points is not a lot of compensation when you're going from a single A credit to a triple B credit. It's a similar level to back where it was in 2021 when the Fed was behind us supporting the economy. There's a lot of liquidity in the system. Times were really good. So we are not finding attractive valuations of triple B's versus single A's. And that's judging by historical standards. Now, the portfolios are holding about 40% of triple B credits. What we have, the changes that we have made to mitigate that is going up in quality. So we have excluded low quality triple B names out of the model and out of accounts and have focused on strong triple B's and a more focus on single A names, particularly the money center banks, as David mentioned earlier, still provides pretty good value. But there's, with the increased supply now, there's been increased supply in industrial single A, particularly in the pharma space and technology space. They're financing a lot of their M&A, that funded M&A through new issues. So that provides another added of another layer of opportunity for us to exploit that.
That's great. That's great. Maybe Anders, perhaps you could just give us a quick update on, you know, what that relationship looks like, double B, single B.
Yeah, absolutely. So we've really seen the compression theme play out in markets since risk has started trading better late October of last year, and we've seen investors looking for that incremental yield pickup by going down the rating structure. So right now, the difference between a triple B and a double B rated bond is around 80 basis points on average, and you pick up an extra 125 basis points by going into single Bs, and how that's translated into the portfolio. Well, over the last 6 months or so, as we've started feeling more comfortable with credit, we've been adding to more names in the single B space, especially for these low-rated names in the single B segment of the market. It really comes down to credit selection. So we've been working closely together with the analysts and picking credits that are fitting for the strategy, and just keep on looking for opportunities there to add performance.
That's great. Thank you so much, guys.
Steve, I think you asked permission for one question. It was three parts to one question, so I'm not counting. Anyway, let's just say, lastly, I want to end up, and this is a little bit of a change here to the model we have been using, is let's leave with a little bit of a call to action, right? So, you know, from what we just heard from the PMs, and I'll point this question to Steve and Neil, what we've heard from the PMs, you know, overlay that with our views and thoughts of the market today, and perhaps our projections of what we're thinking, what should we be telling our financial advisors here, right? What is the strategies that where A, where we're seeing flows, and B, what might be the most appropriate solution based on what our platform provides? Thanks.
Sure. I'll take that first in case Steve takes too much time. if we look to what Chuck had talked about the shape of this muni curve, being so inverted and you know, more inverted than we've seen historically, and our positioning across our intermediate active strategy being barbell, so we take advantage of these really attractive absolute yields that we really haven't seen since, you know, before the financial crisis in 08 and 09. And you lock in those rates on the long end of the curve, those still attractive rates on the long end of the curve. And you're comfortable on the short end of the curve in this barbell, and you're being rewarded for being liquid and in the short end of the curve. I'm really comfortable with a position in across the intermediate strategy, because it allows us to take advantage of the market today, but our liquidity on the short end, whether it be in variable rate notes and 1 and 2 year paper, will allow us to take advantage of the changes that we would expect, a normalization of the yield curve, going through a different rate cycle. I just think that, you know, the next couple of years coming from an elevated period of yields and potentially a lower rate environment will be a really, really good environment for total return in the muni space. So I'm really comfortable positioning with the intermediate muni strategy.
Okay.
Yeah.
Thanks for that.
Thanks for leaving me some time, Neil. I appreciate it.
Yeah.
I would say from a taxable standpoint, folks have really been looking at duration or adding duration, and they're either comfortable doing it in a buy and hold format. So they're looking at the 1 to 10 year ladder and getting rid of some of the shorter dated exposures that they have or portfolios that they have. And then the other conversations, you know, with respect to adding duration, they're doing it through the intermediate corporate bond solution. And they're very comfortable with, outsourcing that active duration component that's embedded in the strategy is one of the key alpha levers for intermediate corporate bonds. So I would say those two strategies we've been having a lot of conversations about, and we've been seeing flows that reflect that. I would also highlight the interest in crossover credit. We've seen assets coming into that SMA, and I think it's because they know we can correctly allocate exposures across IG and high yield effectively. So I think that's another area that we'll continue to see interest in.
Good stuff. Appreciate it. I would say this, just close this out here. We're about another minute. To me, I think patience is a virtue. You know, at the top of the call, Dave Walczak mentioned, you know, the change in what were the expected cuts. I think he said, you know, at the beginning of the year, let's call it 2-3 months ago, where 150 or cuts baked into the market, if not just a tad more, and versus today. Yeah, it's really quite amazing. And so I think the team has done a great job here, and just sort of not trying to get too far ahead of itself, even though at some points the market seemed like it was only heading in one direction. Clearly, this, you can see how fast this can pivot. What I would say lastly is
continue to reach out, bring us into conversations with your clients. We can bring in any of the PMs, and I think there are some really great success stories coming out. A lot of the solutions that we offer, especially that were either mentioned by Steve and or Neil, and I'll give it a shameless plug. We are very close to launching a new 1 to 20 year treasury ladder portfolio in April. That will bring some duration to our taxable side of our portfolios, and we'll bring that into the mix with current portfolios, and I think it'll be a great way to blend that particular strategy in with our current strategies, whether they be on the treasury side, taxable, high yield, or even EM, a great new solution for our product continuum. So with that, I bid you a farewell. Appreciate you tuning in to the March edition of Around the Horn, and we'll talk to you in April. Thank you.
As a firm providing wealth management services to clients, UBS Financial Services, Inc. offers investment advisory services in its capacity as an SEC-registered investment advisor and brokerage services in its capacity as an SEC-registered broker-dealer. Investment advisory services and brokerage services are separate and distinct, differ in material ways, and are governed by different laws and separate arrangements. It is important that you understand the ways in which we conduct business and that you carefully read the agreement and disclosures that we provide to you about the products or services we offer. For more information, please review client relationship summary provided at ubs.com/relationship summary or ask your UBS financial advisor for a copy.